Good morning. Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Wildfire, like actors in a Greek drama, has two opposing faces, one of destruction and another of rejuvenation. In recent years, there's been a growing appreciation of wildfire's regenerative function in forest ecology, but the increase in large, intensely hot megafires poses increased risks to the local communities and economies, and the ability to permanently transform the ecosystems and habitats through which they burn. This morning, we talk with Colin O'Meara, who's president of the National Wildlife Federation, about their new report that discusses the intersection between wildfire, wildlife, climate change, and forest management. Colin, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on again.
We've had you on before to talk about very different things, so why are we talking about fire this time? And I just throw this out. I have done so many shows on fire in the last 6 weeks. It might be part of the same reason. But why is this emphasis on megafires that seems to be so pertinent at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, fires are natural, right? And it can be completely rejuvenating, as the quote from the first line of the report. But we're seeing fires at a duration, intensity, and a level of devastation that we've never seen before. And I think the reason that we're trying to elevate the issues with good folks like yourself is that there are solutions that we can take in the near term to help reduce the catastrophic impact of these fires, while at the same time putting some policies on the ground long term that also address the underlying problems. And, it's heartbreaking to me when, amazing, habitats and communities are destroyed in a way that's not rejuvenating because these fires are so much worse than ever before.
It's actually interesting to me because I've done a whole lot of shows over the last few years about the important role that fire plays in the landscape and in forest ecosystems, and talking particularly about the threat that post-fire logging, sometimes called salvage logging, has on the ability for forests to really rejuvenate themselves after a big fire. But what is different between what we've been experiencing in the last few years? And actually, I'm reading a book right now called Firestorm about megafires.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting book. And it sort of details a problem that goes way, way back, actually. We've been experiencing these super fires for a long time now, for several decades. But what are the conditions that are making these fires less restorative to the landscape and more of a serious problem?
Yeah, no, and it's a great question, and I'm a huge proponent of kind of prescribed burns and places for habitat restoration. And when I was the state secretary in Delaware, I mean, we actually did prescribed burns in the forest in Delaware that are obviously a lot smaller than ones in your neck of the woods. But the biggest difference is that right now we're seeing, typically winters with less snowpack, even though this year was a little bit better. We're seeing hotter, drier summers. We're seeing less soil moisture. We're seeing more species like bark beetles that are obviously ravaging a lot of tree stands. And when you put that all together, combined with the Forest Service spending 60% of its budget on fighting fires instead of actually restoring our forests, you just have a recipe for disasters. And so we're not doing the proactive work, the proactive restoration work that's absolutely essential to restoring our forests and managing for wildlife populations, improving watershed health, and improving the recreation opportunities and creating local economic development opportunities. And then it gets worse every year. And the last few years, we've seen 7 to 8 million acres burned. This year was 8.8. 2 years ago, it was almost 10 million compared to 30 years ago when it was 2 to 3 million. And so we were three times as much in terms of the number of acres, and they're hotter and bigger and more intense. And we've had fires in places like New Mexico that basically burned everything to the ground, to the point where life didn't come back, basically almost getting like a moonscape kind of environment. So, I think that it is fundamentally different than the historical issues that are historical kind of role that fire has played.
Well, it's interesting that one of the fires that you have a photograph of in your report is the Eagle Creek Fire, just about 20 miles east of here in the Columbia River Gorge, that burned at the end of the summer. And a lot of the experts that have, environmental advocates in the region who have gotten to do flyovers over the burn area have talked about how it actually burns in a very healthy way as a mosaic, that there's much of the gorge, most of the gorge is still intact. And I think that there's actually, in that burn area, it's at least almost half of it was completely unburned. So that's the way forest fires are supposed to burn. this is also a very wet area, so there's a different situation than it is just on the east side of the Cascades here, where we have had other issues more like what you're talking about. But I wonder, how do we reconcile those two things? Because I think there can be some confusion about, like, the fire. People thought the Eagle Creek fire was just horrible because it was burning this iconic place that people go to all the time, and not understanding that there is a need for fire as well. So I just wonder how we juggle those two conflicting sentiments.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is where actually understanding the local ecological conditions is incredibly important. And the fact that I even called it ecological conditions probably had, you know, had some of your listeners glaze over. I think at the end of the day, we have to, in the same breath, say that, you know, forest fire is natural, forest management is important, and at the same time talk about kind of these bigger fires that are more intense, being much more extreme and often having the, you know, adverse impacts that that, you know, we don't want to see. But, you know, every case is unique. I think one thing that I think a lot about is how do we kind of move past this kind of preservationist mindset that I think some of the in the conservation community have, where they talk about, you know, kind of anytime, you know, there's, you know, trees cut or small diameter trees or salvage logging or, you know, those types of activities somehow disrupting the kind of forest ecosystem. And, you know, in a lot of these places, like, you want active management of the resource. I mean, of course, you know, you want to protect old growth to the extent that you can. You know, if you're removing trees, they should probably be smaller diameter in most places. But there's a science behind this. There's the resource conservation that I think, particularly more folks are living in cities, and, you know, anytime, you know, you hear these kind of dichotomous debates between, you know, kind of keeping everything exactly the way it was or cutting down everything, you kind of lose the nuance for professional wildlife managers and professional foresters to have the tools that they need to make sure the forests are healthy. And health being defined as kind of tree health and wildlife populations and watershed health and resilience to fires, and managing for those outcomes in a way that's really forward-looking, as we're seeing more impacts on the landscape.
Well, it seems like there's several contributing factors to the situation that we're in now, and we can talk about more about the whole idea that fire suppression has had this impact on making a lot of forests, and particularly in drier areas and pine spruce forests in particular, into tinder boxes. There's also the impact of having too many people living in the wildland-urban interface. And then I was just reading an article before I came into the station about how Instagram is bringing too many people to too many places that used to be remote, because people snap a photograph, put it on their Instagram account, and with the coordinates of how to get there, and suddenly these remote places are swamped with all these people who don't know what to do when they're in the woods. So let's talk about those three factors and how we can address each one of them, starting with the whole issue about fire suppression and what the impact that's had on forests over the last 100 years, or actually more than 100
yeah,
years.
There's places that have done forest, you know, kind of active management and forest restoration as a means of suppression incredibly well, and there's some places that it's horribly backfired. And I think often, you know, the places where it's been the least effective are the places where we try to impose one-size-fits-all solutions that don't really match the local forest conditions and the local combination of weather patterns as well as the forest ecology. And so finding, you know, solutions that are local. But, yeah, it's absolutely a mixed bag. And it was funny, I was talking to somebody from Western or Eastern Washington, and, you know, fairly conservative guy, and he said, you know, he's like, suppression efforts have been an abject failure. And just kind of a black and white kind of sentence. And I said, well, some have. I said, some have been a huge success. And I think it just comes back to the nuance of, you know, having plans that are kind of developed by scientists and not politicians, and, you know, really trying to make sure the local communities are engaged. So on the first one, I think, you know, it's just not black or white, and it's more complicated. But I feel strongly that when you have the best decisions and the best likelihood of success comes when you have the most local input from the local state agencies, you know, local folks on the ground, you know, folks from local universities, conservation groups, all working together, trying to find the solutions that make sense. Because those are the projects that, you know, tend to have a greater success rate than ones that are designed in, you know, in the halls of D.C. rather than in the local communities.
Well, one of the things that we've seen happens every time there's large fires, whether it was in 2002, 2003, or after all the fires this summer, but from our viewpoint, after the Eagle Creek fire ignited, that there's all this cry in Congress to go in and log That's the way to save the forest is to log them. And so there's currently a bill that's, I think it might have already passed the House. I'm not sure, but it's definitely, that would basically do away with most environmental regulations and any public comment and just go in and log, I guess, actually wilderness areas, but definitely scenic areas like the Columbia River Gorge. And one of the proponents of this bill is our Congressman Greg Walden, whose district is half of the Eagle Creek burn was his district. How do we address that kind of mentality? Because it seems to me that that's not the most thoughtful or scientific way to approach dealing with wildfires.
No, exactly. And I think, I was testifying before the Senate a few weeks ago on a Senate version of a similar bill to the one that just passed the House. And my point was that we have to fix the funding crisis first, right? Because if you don't have money for restoration, like, all these changes to management practices don't matter, because it means that we're spending everything on fighting the fires instead of actually trying to restore the forest. But also, like, I'm not convinced that the answer is throwing out, environmental reviews and reducing, kind of transparency. I understand the frustration. I mean, I think there are a lot of good projects that wind up in litigation. I think there's a lot of good projects that get stalled for years because of bureaucratic processes. But my answer would be to embolden local communities to get, more local input and more projects on the ground that way, as opposed to kind of short-circuiting a lot of these processes. And so, our argument is that we should have, if there are going to be changes, they should be surgical, they should be addressing specific problems, but that we can still have a good level of environmental review, a rigorous review that's also efficient. We shouldn't have to choose between the two. And frankly, that's the conversation in the Senate. I mean, the House conversation was probably a little less nuanced given the kind of majority rules there. But the Senate, if they're going to pass anything, it's going to have to be bipartisan. And we're seeing Republicans and Democrats come together for a more common sense, kind of moderate proposal that balances these funding needs with some common sense management improvements. And I think that's where it'll come out. So I don't think what comes out of the Congress in the next 2 months, if anything, will be a much more rational overall package than some of the proposals to date.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Colin O'Mara, who is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, and we're talking about the impacts of all these mega fires that have been burning a lot across the West, but also in the Southeast as well, over the last number of years, particularly this summer. And one more thing about this bill. Now, I've been getting lots of emails from our Senator Jeff Merkley, who is basically saying the same things you're saying. And he and Ron Wyden and a lot of others, I mean, I think the entire West Coast Senate delegation is calling for disaster funding for wildfire. So let's talk a bit about this whole funding conundrum and how fires are paid for now and how that's affecting the ability of the Forest Service to actually do any kind of restoration or protection for the forest from fire.
Yeah, so the biggest conundrum comes back to it's an inequity between the way we handle the forest fire crises versus other natural disasters like hurricanes or floods or tornadoes. And in the latter case, FEMA comes in, pays for most of the funding. There's local cost share arrangements. There's kind of full breadth and depth of the federal government. At least that's how it's supposed to respond. Obviously, the response in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands was an absolute disgrace. But that's how it's supposed to work. Forest fires are treated completely differently. The Forest Service is supposed to manage all the costs for firefighting in their own budget. There is no separate fund that they can really tap into. FEMA doesn't really come into play unless there's like local communities that are impacted. But that's not really about the forest. It's really about the community. And so all those tools that other communities have access to that are impacted by other types of natural disasters don't really apply when they come to our forests. And what it's meant is that the Forest Service has gone from spending 15% of its budget fighting fires in 1980 to almost 60% this year. We're going to be at like 56, 57, 58% when the final numbers come in. So, it's a fourfold increase over 35 years, and the amount of money that the percentage of their budget that they're spending on forest fires. And the problem is that what they're doing to meet that need is they're raiding all the other programs. So all the wildlife habitat programs and the restoration programs and all the projects they're trying to get done, they steal money from region to region. So if there's a bad fire in Tennessee, they'll take money from the West. If there's bad fires in the West, they'll take money from the East Coast forests. And at the end of the day, we're only just digging ourselves a bigger and bigger hole, because what I call the restoration deficit gets bigger and bigger. And right now, I mean, the estimates are as few as 65 million acres and as many as 82 million acres require significant restoration in the next few years. And that number continues to grow because we don't have the money, because we're focused on spending the money on fighting the fires. And so Senator Wyden has been an incredible leader on this, working with Senator Crapo from Idaho, working with Senator Merkley, and working with Senators Cantwell and Murray, working with Jim Risch from Idaho, you know, folks like John Tester and Martin Heinrich and Senator Feinstein from California, have all been kind of bringing folks together across party lines, trying to find solutions. And I'm optimistic that we can actually get it done, because it is very bipartisan, but it seems like common sense, and I just feel like, you know, 50 folks shouldn't have had to die to fix some of these problems. And I mean, this has been a policy that has been debated for the last four Congresses, and only now are we kind of at the one-yard line, hopefully able to punch it into the end zone.
Well, you're talking about how they take resources from one region to fight a fire in another region and basically continually running in this fire deficit. But the other thing I wonder about, I was talking with Dominic Della Sala, who's a forest fire ecologist down in Ashland, Oregon, a few weeks ago, and he talked about how there was not enough resources to fight the fires in the wine country in California because they were being used to fight a wilderness fire in southwestern Oregon and the Chekhov Bar fire. And he thought that there were like way too many resources fighting this wilderness fire, which was pretty much could burn itself out, and not enough resources to fight a fire that was like right in the middle of, you know, was burning downtowns. So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on how much resources we should really be devoting to fighting fires in wilderness areas, when we should choose to fight them and when we shouldn't, and how does that also strain the resource budget from fighting fires closer to where there's people that whose lives are at stake?
Yeah, I mean, I think he brings up a good point in that, I mean, resources are finite, and obviously there's, you know, much less than there needs to be. You know, I mean, there obviously should be more focus on the kind of the urban land, the wildlands urban interface, the WUI, they call it. But at the same time, like, I'm not willing to forsake, you know, some of these other areas that, you know, may have a fire that is catastrophic, that, you know, is much worse than a, you know, kind of what's anticipated or what's normal, knowing that the impacts that can have on water quality for adjacent communities, on recreation, on wildlife populations, and everything else. And so I guess I'm just not willing to accept the scarcity mindset that comment kind of exacerbates, right? Because, I mean, the point he's making is that there's not enough money, so therefore we should focus on these communities. I'm not willing to accept the premise that there shouldn't be more money. And so, yes, I agree. If we're unable to successfully pass this legislation and others, that there needs to be more consideration. Part of it's also timing, right? Because, like, a lot of the fires in, you know, some of the wildlands that were wilderness areas in Montana and in Oregon and other places were slightly earlier, you know, in kind of August and September and October, where we saw the worst of the fires in California in October and November. And so, you know, I mean, I do think that they're mainly October, but there's this timing issue when you're playing with finite resources. But I also don't want to see folks kind of keep resources in reserve and allow an important habitat corridor to get destroyed because, you know, they're anticipating something in a more urban area. So, you know, I think this gets back to the way Congress budgets and being able to access additional funds when there is a particularly bad year, so you're not having to make these kind of Faustian choices.
Well, I think some of Dominic's point was not necessarily just, you know, reserving money for the possibility of there being a fire closer to human settlement, but also his belief that most of the firefighting that goes on in wilderness areas probably doesn't need to be done. And I'm wondering what your take on that is. How would you decide when to fight a fire in a wilderness area and when to let it burn?
Right. And so, yeah. So, I mean, I use the test that the Forest Service uses, which is when there's potential for kind of ecological disasters that are much, you know, kind of having that affect multiple outcomes. And so, you know, it's like fires that have the potential to, you know, spread rapidly into other areas, maybe even urbanized areas, because of kind of tree health in different corridors, places that have impacts on water quality, places where you have, you know, restoration projects or certain features you're trying to conserve, you know, in some cases recreational amenities. And I do think that there's a thoughtful, you know, conversation to be had there. You know, and like we said at the beginning of the conversation, there are places where, you know, fire is absolutely rejuvenating and helpful. But I want scientists making the call. I want foresters like the gentleman making that call, rather than, you know, politicians in Washington.
You know, I'm thinking about thinking about the difference between having one of your very favorite areas burn and having some other area that is somebody else's favorite area, probably, but you don't happen to know it. Because I've had experience in the last few years of having two of my very favorite areas burn where I go hiking all the time. And one was the north face of Mount Hood. Actually, three, as Mount Jefferson burned right where I went backpacking a couple years ago until I fell in love with that area. And that was one of the big fires in Oregon this summer as well. But I've spent a lot of time hiking up on the north face of Mount Hood since the fire in 2012. And it's a fascinating experience watching the post-fire landscape rejuvenate. And that was an example of a fire that needed to burn. I don't have the same, I've gone through the gorge a few times since the fire. I don't have exactly the same feeling about that. And some of it might be just residual anger at the fact that it was set by an idiot kid. You know, right. It did not need to be set. And it was set in a way, because it was set at the bottom of the canyon, it was exactly the opposite pattern of the way fires usually burn when they're started by lightning strikes. So I'm kind of weighing these different emotional responses that we have. But I also see another big difference is that the gorge fire was, even though it's in some pretty remote areas, and most of the burn you can't see from the freeway, but it also came right down to the freeway, and it also threatened a number of communities. And the fire in Mount Hood a few years ago possibly could have threatened our water supply in Portland, the Bull Run Reserve, but it didn't. Actually, the fire at Eagle Creek also came really close to the Bull Run Reserve. But there seems like, in the case of the Mount Hood fire, it was a fire that you just have. They did some firefighting, but basically, yeah, it burned itself out. And in the gorge, yeah, it burned itself out too, but with a lot of help.
No, absolutely. And I think, and I had a chance to hike Mount Hood, and just absolutely spectacular. It's one of the most iconic experiences everyone should have. I do think there's a difference, right? And I think this is where having good forest planning, that has local input, makes sense, because I'd much rather be in a position proactively to have local communities have input, based on, conditions, saying, this is kind of ripe for a 7-year fire cycle or whatever it is. So then when a lightning strike or an idiot kind of, causes one, that all of a sudden you're making decisions based on best science and kind of pre-planning, as opposed to trying to make decisions in the moment, because there always will be this NIMBY issue, right? And I think it's hard. It's counterintuitive to say that, fire is actually healthy for the environment when, all they're seeing is, smoke in the air and kind of bright orange embers. So, I just think the more that we have kind of done the pre-work to make sure that we're consciously making decisions one way or the other, the more beneficial kind of ecological outcomes we'll have, at least, and also more defensible decisions we'll have. And so one of the things that's in the megafires report that the National Wildlife Federation just put out is really trying to make sure that we are getting these plans done, make sure we have the resources to do the good proactive work and some of the earlier restoration work, so you can make these active decisions in real time before the crisis hits, instead of during.
Well, I just got a call from a listener who is a longtime resident in McKenzie Bridge, east of Eugene, Oregon, and he's a grassroots activist in sustainable forest management, and he's actually somebody who's called into the show a number of times with his take on the ways to manage forests. His claim is that clear-cutting is more at fault in causing forest fires and fire suppression. And I remember when I was doing a project about the Biscuit Fire back in 2002 and talked to a number of environmental activists down Southern Oregon who pointed out that areas that had been salvage logged from a previous fire a few years earlier that burnt the same area, those areas burnt much worse than some of the areas that had not been burnt or had been allowed to grow back. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think there's no one-size-fits-all solution, right? I mean, there's places where kind of the fuel reduction strategies, getting rid of small diameter trees and dead trees can make a lot of sense. There's a lot of places where, you want the biomass in the actual forest for a variety of conservation reasons. And so I think, there are places where clear cuts have been absolutely devastating when fires came through later, because it allowed, you had jumps, or you had, places that were impacted that wouldn't have been otherwise if there was kind of a more balanced approach to forest management. I've also seen places that have had good, management and removal of some fuels and things like that had a fraction of the impact that they would have had if a whole bunch of, dead trees and small trees were still standing. So, the challenge in all this stuff is that, the forest ecology and now, even just within different parts of Oregon, are fundamentally different from each other. And so I think it's just important to know the local context, is instead of trying to have these one-size-fits-all solution where, like, clear-cutting is always good or it's always bad, or, I mean, most of the time it can be done better. I mean, I'm very much a proponent of very kind of surgical, kind of strategic thinning. But there's, you know, I think there's a challenge right now in Washington, at least, around having a more nuanced debate when folks want these kind of clean one-size-fits-all solutions, and when we know from years of experience that doesn't work.
Well, one thing's interesting about the Eagle Creek fire, which spurred on, you know, this debate in Congress, or rather a rampage in Congress, let's go clear cut the forest to save the forest from itself. But Jerry Franklin, forest ecologist up in the University of Washington in Seattle, I heard an interview that he did where he was talking about how in the Columbia River Gorge, it's so wet, it's not an issue of fire suppression. The fires suppress themselves, and that when it does burn, it's a good thing. And the fire, and he was one of the people who pointed out that the fire did burn in a mosaic pattern and basically was good for forest health. So I think that that's another thing where we really need to, like, watch who's jumping on what bandwagon exactly. And to use which fire, you know, for their cause.
Well, and then that's the challenge, right? I mean, I feel like, you know, this is, as facts have less and less currency in Washington in particular, I mean, you can find an example of, you know, forest practices in any direction to support, you know, and single anecdote to support any position about what should happen. And I think, you know, for me, it's just, you know, the science needs to still be the science. And, you know, we're looking at, you know, the overall forest health and the overall kind of evidence across, you know, hundreds of, you know, different types of forest systems in different parts of the country to try to make the best decisions. But that level of nuance is unfortunately increasingly difficult to convey in a 140-character world.
It certainly does. Well, this morning we're talking with Colin O'Mara, who's president of the National Wildlife Federation, and we're talking about megafires. So this term has been thrown around a lot, and I just wanted, first of all, to get a definition. What do you consider the size a fire needs to be to call it a megafire?
Yeah, so it's not. It's basically a deviation from the historical norms. And so, right, so rather than saying it's, you know, it's 100 or, you know, 500 or, you know, 1,000 acres or whatever that number is, it's basically like looking at historical patterns and then looking at things that are, you know, at least 1 to 2 standard deviations bigger, longer, you know, kind of using a combination of size, duration, and intensity as a way to look at the increase in the kind of number of megafires compared to the traditional levels of fire. And, you know, and I think at the aggregate level, as I mentioned before, the, you know, this idea that we went from, you know, 2 to 3 million acres of kind of forest burning a year is kind of at a fairly steady level for, you know, 50 years or 60 years, and now we're in, you know, 7.5, 8, 8.5 million acres a year. So it's a pretty dramatic, you know, 2 to 3-fold increase. And a lot of that's because of these fires that are just, frankly, just bigger than anything we've seen before.
Well, I mean, I found it interesting to note that the Eagle Creek fire burned close to 50,000 acres. The last fire of note in the gorge was in 1991 and burned a very similar area, and it was about 1,000 acres. It was also it was naturally started. So let's look at, what do you think are some of the reasons why the Multnomah Falls 91 fire was so much smaller than this year's Eagle Creek fire?
My guess, I mean, that is a pretty wet area. I mean, I know it was a little bit drier this year than before. I mean, the soil, I mean, for me, like, the easiest indicator is soil moisture and kind of soil health. Because, I mean, obviously the damper it is, the less these things tend to spread. And then looking at, you know, impacts of kind of number of dead trees, small diameter trees, things that can act as kindling to kind of expend and allow the jumps, as these fires tend to jump into bigger and bigger areas. But, you know, I mean, I've only been there once. My guess would be, though, that it's basic kind of ecological conditions that just allowed it to be that much bigger than before. But I'd be curious on your take on the ground.
Well, one of the things that was interesting, I mean, 2015, which was a really big fire year. That was a really, really dry year. In fact, I was personally freaking out that whole summer, thinking I had to move to the coast. I could, you know, it was just really, really hot, really, really dry. Then last summer was in 2016 was a much more benign, normal summer, maybe a little bit on the cool side. And then this summer started out being the wettest, coldest summer. It took forever to start. We had a huge amount of snow. We had like 17 inches excess rain. Nobody thought there'd be a bad fire season. And then all of a sudden, in the beginning of August, we started having this drought and it was incredibly hot. And there's fires burning in British Columbia and there's fire burning everywhere. There was smoke in the air in Portland a good part of the summer, of the end of the summer. So what really struck me was that the conditions changed so dramatically. And so that makes me wonder, how much does this have to do with climate change?
That's exactly right. And I think I actually used that exact example when I was testifying about, like, this was a good snowpack year, right? I mean, like, if you look in Montana and Washington and Oregon, I mean, like, the levels were pretty good. The ski season was good for folks that have, you know, those kind of assets in their community. But things change. And, you know, the combination of the hotter, drier kind of drought in those early months in the summer, you know, basically evaporated or eviscerated, you know, all the kind of additional soil moisture that you had. One thing is that, I mean, some of the snowpack itself, because grounds were a little harder because of the dry season last year in some places, a lot of it wasn't fully absorbed into the soils, and so you know, some of it kind of ran off at a velocity that kind of didn't have the full benefit that you might have otherwise had for that level of precipitation. But things can change quickly, and this is where, you know, kind of understanding how climactic cycles work and, you know, how it's not going to be completely linear, but all the directionality is that, you know, temperatures are increasing, precipitation is decreasing in many places, and then you also have, you know, more invasive species and kind of more extreme, you know, weather events. I mean, you put that cocktail together, and you have, you know, all the ingredients for, instead of a 1,000-acre fire, a 50,000-acre fire.
I'm thinking, too, it's really strange because I went hiking, I guess it was the third week in June, up on the north side of Mount Hood, and got stopped by snow a mile up. I mean, I wasn't even up to Timberline Trail yet. And usually you can get to the Timberline Trail by mid-June, and there's no snow on it, or at least there's very little snow on it. And so that's the other thing that was very strange, was that the summer was really shortened. I mean, it didn't really start until July 4th, which is kind of a joke around here. The summer starts on July 4th, but usually the snow is gone well before July 4th. And then we had this very intense hot period, and now it's snowing again. So, you know, it's like trying to make sense of this. And the only thing I can hope about the fact that we had early rain and really early snow this fall is that maybe it'll compensate and help heal what we went on this summer, but I don't know.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, in Syracuse, the real upstate New York, right? And we had, you know, kind of two seasons, winter and August. And it is interesting, though, right? I mean, like, things are changing. The growing seasons are getting longer. You know, I mean, in the precipitation, like, if it comes at a kind of a volume and over a duration of time where it can kind of absorb into the systems and help, you know, kind of rebuild, you know, like I said, like soil health and kind of not just kind of flash flood out when it melts, if that melt doesn't occur too quickly, it can be incredibly rejuvenating and act as a great suppressant for the catastrophic impacts that we're talking about. But if you have, you know, if you go from really, really cold temperatures and a lot of precipitation to really, really hot temperatures fairly quickly, and all of a sudden you wind up with, you know, kind of flooding events rather than kind of a gradual melt, you lose a lot of that potential benefit. So, I mean, I think, and this is where, like, the nuance is important. I love the format of your show where you can actually get into these issues because, you know, folks want to say, oh, my God, we had a big snow, so therefore global warming is fake, right? Or, oh, my God, like, the summer had a cold spell, so therefore, you know, it's not real. And it's all about the trends, right? It's all about the systemic trends. And what we're seeing is just much more volatility in the system. But all the, you know, all the indicators are that,
we just,
you know,
lost you. All the
longer, hotter, drier summers and shorter winters with less precipitation on average over time.
Well, let's talk about some other factors that are causing the forest to burn more. Let's talk about insects.
Yeah. Great. I mean, you can't talk about forest health without talking about bark beetles in particular. And, you know, when you look at the range expanding, like the populations not dying off because of less harsh winters. These are critters that, you know, have done incredible devastation, and I think much worse than folks anticipated, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so, again, I mean, I'd love to see management tools that allow us to address that kind of issue, as opposed to some of these more generalized proposals in Congress. But yeah, I mean, you can't talk about forest health without understanding how the kind of the invertebrate ecology is changing rapidly in some of these places.
I noticed when I was hiking on Mount Hood this summer before the fire that I saw the first time I was really noticing bark beetle death up on the on the mountain. And I mean, I've seen a lot of it in Southern California, or in Southern Oregon, Northern California, and also in British Columbia, in Alberta. But I hadn't seen it on Mount Hood, and so I'm wondering about how. I mean, I don't know what kinds of conditions the trees were between Mount Hood and Eagle Creek that were part of the burn, but I'm wondering if it's possible that, again, maybe there are a lot more trees that were diseased than might have been 10 years ago.
I mean, it would match all the patterns. I should know the forest plan a little better before speaking on the specifics, but yeah, I mean, that's consistent with what we're seeing other places, that between different diseases and different kind of infestations of insects that were not nearly as prevalent in some of these areas before, it's just another contributing factor. And I think that's the hard part for, you know, a lot of folks to kind of wrap their heads around, especially in Washington, where they're dealing with 1,000 other issues that are equally complex. But there's no silver bullet, right? I mean, it's like, you know, it's a combination of, you know, these ecological conditions and insects and management practices, and you can't forget the climate impacts and the role of, you know, kind of carbon pollution and greenhouse gas emissions and kind of, you know, changing the overall system dynamics. I just think we just need to have a much less political, much more kind of science-based conversation. But that's a tall order in a, you know, a Congress that's basically being whipsawed by the tweets of the day.
Well, it seems that this is more of a challenge with the bugs. I mean, we can do things to, we can restore fire to the landscape, which we probably should talk a bit more about. We yep. can deal with trying to thin the forest if necessary, and other kinds of treatments that would reduce some of the fire hazard. And we can also, we should also talk a bit more about making people who live at the edge of the forest a little bit more fire resilient themselves. However, yeah. What can we do about the bugs? Because there was a big movement a few years ago when the bark beetle epidemic really started spreading up through Canada yeah. of, well, let's just cut down all the trees where the bark beetles are. Right. But is there a solution to dealing with this the fact that these bugs are living much longer life cycles and can do a lot more damage to the forest than they could have 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, there is no easy answer. There's some innovation I think is interesting around kind of resiliency and, you know, maybe even trying to get at populations through different efforts to try to make kind of basically treat trees so they're, you know, kind of immune to the impacts. I mean, what always worries me there is that, you know, evolution has a scary way of making, if we have super resilient trees, we'll have super resilient bugs at some point. And so how do we manage them in a way that actually makes sense? Obviously the cutting our way to addressing the problem was unsuccessful in pretty much every place that tried it. There's not a clean answer. I think there's some innovative research going on in a bunch of universities across the West, trying to get at, you know, different kinds of solutions, whether that's trying to, you know, sterilization technologies and some other things on the population side, except the problem is that it's so diffuse. Trying to use that as a mechanism for population level decrease is almost impossible. I think there's some innovative stuff on the tree side, right, with some of the injections and some of the things that folks are trying to figure out ways to have the trees more resistant. I do worry long term about the efficacy of that, but it could buy us time. But really, I mean, the only way to kind of deal with this problem long term is to address the underlying climate impacts that are allowing these beetles to, you know, expand their range and expand their longevity and their population size at such an alarming rate.
Well, another issue that seems like it's the easiest and at the same time the hardest issue to deal with is developing fire resilience in communities that have grown up inside and right close to forests. So how do we deal with the human factor here?
Yeah, I really appreciate you raising this too, because this is both the easiest and also, you know, one of the more controversial. I'll use the California example rather than an Oregon example. But, you know, there are a whole lot of folks with a whole lot of money that were trying to leave the congestion of the Bay Area to build these, you know, palatial estates in the middle of forests in Northern California. And there was very little thought to the siting, the fire impacts, the need for more resilient building materials, safety routes, those kind of things. And some communities do better than others. But, you know, at least in the case of I had a friend at FEMA that used to joke that, you know, flooding is natural, but disasters are man-made. and that we've got to allow ourselves to be put, you know, putting folks in harm's way repeatedly. And we've done this for years with, like, the flood insurance program that kind of subsidizes development on the coast. And we're doing the same thing through planning decisions in some of these forested areas. And I think, for me, I'm not anti-development, but I do think there should be much more transparency about the potential impacts. I think we have to have much more honest conversations about what level of suppression, what level of assistance folks can actually expect if they are going to put themselves in harm's way, what level of materials they should be building with to try to reduce the chance of catastrophic impacts, and then what services can government provide and should government provide if there's a rescue scenario where folks are in harm's way. Because, you know, there were a whole lot of folks that died in these last few rounds that were basically trying to save folks that were in unsafe areas. And, you know, I think anytime somebody loses their life because of that, we have to go back and look at the policy decisions that were made years ago that allowed the situation to occur. So again, not an easy answer, but, you know, I mean, I just think, especially in an environment where local governments are being asked to do more with less, that so many of these governments are funded based on property taxes. And so, you know, you allow that big development and, you know, regardless of where it is, you get that new revenue and all of a sudden you can afford that, you know, additional cop or that additional, you know, firefighter or whatever, those trade-offs are rarely worth the potential, you know, devastating impacts to the community.
Well, I find it kind of very painfully ironic. I mean, people in Northern California would look south to people who have been building in canyons and woodlands and all kinds of fire-prone areas, most notably Malibu, for decades and decades, and that they get burnt out as part of life in the L.A. areas. You get burnt out every so often. And people in Northern California scratching their heads like, why would you want to live that way? And then waking up and realizing this past October that they had done the same thing in Sonoma and parts of Mendocino and Napa counties. So, I mean, one of the things that I look at from perspective here in Oregon, when we have massive fires, and including the Eagle Creek fire, which burned really close to Portland, if this had been California, there would have been hundreds of people probably killed, and thousands of people living in the hills and in the canyons in the gorge. But because of our land use laws, there are just people living at either end of the scenic area and nobody living in it to speak of. So do you think there's a model for, like, the kind of land use laws that Oregon has that might help the rest of the West in particular, but probably also parts of Tennessee and Georgia and other places that are burning now, to look at ways of keeping people out of the woods?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think Oregon's been a pioneer on a lot of these things. And, I mean, I think that the hard part is that we equate, like, latitude and, like, temperature with fire risk in a lot of places, right? Where it's like, well, I don't live in Scottsdale, Arizona, or L.A., so therefore it's not that hot here. And, you know, the old Mark Twain quote about the coldest winter ever spent being in the summer in San Francisco. So like, oh, well, it's not that hot here, so therefore we can't have these kind of horrific fires. And unfortunately, I mean, temperature is only one factor. Frankly, you know, kind of drought and precipitation is a better one. And so we have to kind of rethink the you know, way we kind of perceive risk in these communities. And I think for me, the more information we give to the public in a very digestible way, the better. Because I have to think, if folks knew that they were in an area that was likely to be flooded or likely to have, you know, fire come through, they're much less likely to, you know, buy in those areas. I mean, insurance becomes difficult if you have more transparent markets, which obviously is a consideration for most Americans because they don't want to have a house, so they can't insure it. And then also the need to have more resistant materials so they're not putting their loved ones in harm's way. I mean, I think those are honest conversations, and that shouldn't be a Republican or Democratic issue. You know, I mean, folks will talk about land use planning and assume it's some kind of, you know, liberal conspiracy. But at the end of the day, I mean, if we don't do land use planning well, we wind up with these kind of catastrophic body counts. And that's the part that's, you know, I think the most heartbreaking is that I think a lot of the damage in some of these places, not all of them, but could have been avoided if we had more honest conversations about actual risks in with different types of siting alternatives.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Colin O'Mara, who's president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We're talking about mega fires. In the remaining part of the show, I wanted to talk about some solutions. I mean, you have a bunch of recommendations at the end of the report. So what would you like to see being done, and how can listeners become engaged in taking the steps so that we can, first of all, acknowledge that we're having more serious fires than ever before, and then starting to do something to mitigate that problem?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the question. I think first and foremost, We need to elevate the profile of the crisis and the fact that, you know, we are experiencing much more without losing the nuance that, you know, fire is important and fire is natural in many places. We don't want to lose that important fact, but that this is a crisis that requires, it's a national crisis, requires a national solution. And frankly, I mean, there was very little coverage of any of the fires out west before Santa Rosa. Even the LA fires is more of a regional story this year, and the Oregon story barely penetrated national news at all. And so, I mean, I think we unfortunately become a little immune to some of these challenges because, you know, the crazy thing coming out of D.C. or out of the White House just tends to, you know, swamp the news cycle. So keeping the issue visible is important. So, you know, social media, making sure they're talking to folks in other parts of the country. The second thing is really supporting Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley's efforts on the fire funding fix, really resolving this budget issue that for years has really plagued our forest health and is contributing to these massive, these just increasingly large forest fires in many places. The second is really getting involved locally with their local communities that are engaged in forestry issues. I do think the more folks are involved in management issues, and I think there's some federal tools that can be provided, but being actively engaged, particularly folks that live in a more rural kind of forested area, I think the more voices, the better. And then I also think there's some long-term things we have to do around making sure that kind of the best climate science is going into the way we manage our forests, making sure that we're addressing the carbon and other greenhouse gases that are fueling climate impacts. But obviously in the current politics, that's maybe a few more years out, but really encouraging Governor Brown and others to really lead by example, continue to.
Both Governor Browns. California.
Yeah, both Governor Browns. Exactly. No, exactly. I mean, you have three of the best governors in the country on your coast right now. And I think, you know, the more they can do to kind of show the way and show that it's not only good for the environment, but it's great for the economy. I mean, I love that, you know, Governor Inslee's been all over the place, all over Governor Brown. Governor Sue Brown has been a huge leader since she stepped in, and Governor, you know, Jerry Brown's, you know, one of my all-time heroes for, you know, his just relentless advocacy of kind of what he sees as right. So, you know, I mean, I think really supporting those leaders and helping them go even further, and frankly, getting engaged with local conservation groups that are trying to help communities manage these things. I just think, you know, now is the time for every, you know, Oregonian and, you know, every kind of American to kind of stand up and get involved in their local communities, and that's the best way we can kind of survive the next couple of years and hopefully make some big changes in the future.
Well, if you want to get engaged this week, actually, there's an event that Friends of the Columbia Gorge is sponsoring after the smoke clears, and they are calling for joining them for a series of educational forums on the Columbia, on the Eagle Creek fire and how our community can help Columbia River Gorge forests recover. And the event is happening in Portland Wednesday, November 15th. It's this Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. And it's at Revolution Hall at 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Southeast Portland. There's another one in Troutdale on the 29th, a couple Wednesdays away, and it's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at McMiniman's Edgefield at 1226 Southwest Halsey Street in Troutdale. And finally, one in Hood River at Hood River Valley High School, 1220 Indian Creek Road, and that's on Thursday, November 30th. So these are all forums about kind of updates on what's happening with the Columbia Gorge, how to help it to recover. And the main way to help it recover, according to these people, and I guess my opinion too, is to stop the salvage logging bill from going through and to take some of the measures that Colin has been talking about today that would really promote forest health as opposed to just logging away what's left. So that's what you can do here. And the other thing, would you suggest, are there any actions people can take in Washington to really, we can write and call our Congress people, our senators are definitely, I think, on the side of really looking at a nuanced way of dealing with forest management. But of course, we have a couple Congress people coming from Oregon who maybe want to be enticed to think differently, mainly Greg Walden and Kurt Schrader. So what would you suggest that people who live in their districts do?
Yeah, I think look, and I've had the privilege of working with both Congressman Chairman Walden and Congressman Schrader on a lot of issues, and sometimes we agree and sometimes we disagree. I mean, I think what they're working on now on the forestry side is way too far from where we should be having the conversation as we're having it in the Senate on the other side. But I mean, I think the more that they can try, you know, talk to him, talk to his district representatives, you know, there is this is one of those issues that's increasingly shaping up, not along political lines. I think there are folks that, you know, do see opportunities to make this the way to have more board feet coming out of the forest and, you know, think about only the economic impacts, not the long-term sustainability. But I'm finding most folks, when you get into a conversation, they actually just want to find solutions that want to, you know, kind of that actually work on the ground. And so I would encourage folks, I mean, don't write them off. And Chairman Walden in particular is a I find him to be a very thoughtful guy. Again, we have disagreed on major things, but I've always been able to have a conversation with him on kind of big issues. And I just think the more they're hearing from local voices, not in from a progressive wing, but just frankly as Oregonians, they're concerned about their communities and their safety and their natural treasures. You know, there might be some movement there. Because frankly, what's going to happen in D.C. Well, there'll be a ping pong. So the House passed their bill. The Senate's going to basically reject it. They won't really act on it. They'll have a much more moderate bipartisan version that hopefully comes out. Then hopefully that gets stuck to whatever big legislative package is coming out at the end of the year. And then the House will have to make a decision whether to live with the Senate version or to kind of reject it. And I think, you know, the more that we're doing work with those members to, you know, really be supportive of a solution, a more moderate, more pragmatic, bipartisan solution, the more that, you know, folks feel the political support to be part of that, even if some of their individual constituencies might want something that's a little more hardline, the more likely we can get that done in the fall. So, and the other thing too, I'd encourage if folks are actually visiting D.C., visiting the offices and, you know, going in person. I mean, it's great to see the tweets and the Facebook posts and the emails. But like, there's nothing better than calls and visits. And so I know it takes more time, but, you know, trying to get on somebody's calendar and, you know, actually making the case in person. And I do encourage everyone to go to the National Wildlife Federation's website. It's www.nwf.org. The megafire report's right on the homepage. If folks want to read up a little bit more on some of the solutions we're proposing. And then our state affiliate in Oregon is the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, which has done a lot to try to restore water quality in a lot of the national forests, trying to increase salmon runs and steelhead runs. And so, you know, a lot of good resources available if folks want to learn more. But I do think face-to-face contact, you know, if there's town hall meetings, if there's opportunities to go to district offices, I mean, that's where it's really hard to deny, you know, citizens when they come in with facts on their side and with, you know, kind of impassioned pleas for help in person. It's much easier to ignore an electronic communication.
Well, Colin, it's really good talking with you. I'm glad we had time to talk about megafires today. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for everything you all do. I really appreciate your program.
Okay, and we'll talk again soon, I hope. This morning, we've been talking with Colin O'Mara, who's president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, and you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. Next week, we're going to be talking with Nicole Whitman-Evans with the Wilderness Society about renewed efforts to turn the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge back to oil drilling. And if you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.